There's said to be an old art dealer in Canton. When someone said to him, is this painting that you're selling me any good? The dealer would look at him rather quizzically and then simply say, my friend, open the door. That was the only answer he ever would give. In other words, in attempting to determine value, we have to open a door inside of ourselves. There has to be some way by which we are able to establish value apart from tradition and apart from the simple testimony of our common judgment. There has to be a certain intuiting process go on when we attempt to determine rightness, truth, reality, and fact. Now, there are some facts that are so obvious that through general and common acceptance, we are in agreement about them. But even in the world of facts, there are many rather elusive truths that cannot be quickly and easily discovered. To find these, we must learn to use gradually a certain extrasensory band of faculties and powers. The search for value, then, does sharpen our intuition. It makes us more observant of small things. It makes us more aware of those trifles which together make perfection. This power of deeper discernment is not limited to trading in fine arts. It becomes a very useful tool in every phase of daily living. If we are able to instinctively and intuitively grasp value, it will help us wherever we must decide as to the merit of anything. Some people are interested in trying to determine the value of a religion. Others may be concerned with the value of an art or a science, or still a piece of merchandise, or an investment, or the value of an affection or a friendship. All of these values are essentially intangibles. And most values that we know today are subject to imposture. Things are not always what they appear to be. Persons are not what they claim to be. And unless we have some judgment, intuitive in ourselves, our lives are likely to be filled with disillusionments and disappointments and discouragements. The only protection that we have against being imposed upon in one way or another is our own ability to evaluate. Therefore, we must learn not only to recognize value, but we must learn to take hold of it, to grasp at it when the emergency or situation arises in which decision must be made. In the Zen story, the little boy first sees the mysterious black ox that is the symbol to a measure of his search for reality. Having found the ox, he must next capture the ox. He must take hold of it and bridle it. And in the same way, in our search for value, when we have discovered it, we must make the decision which this value indicates to be necessary. In our world of material experiences, we are all required to pay for value. In some way, value is expensive. And the more valuable, the more likely we must pay well for that which we desire. Consequently, it becomes important to know when to save and when to spend, when it is wise to perhaps overinvest, and again, when it is wise not to invest at all. Thus, judgment is closely associated with the whole fact of value. Most persons who have been interested in art, culture, and related fields over the period of years have had adventures with their own personal weakness, as this has bearing upon value. Indecision comes in very frequently. And in indecision, we are likely to lose that which is valuable or to settle for something else which is less valuable. So prudence, thoughtfulness, decision, these problems are ever present where value is a factor in a transaction. In one simple way, for example, decision in life. If it is in terms of true value, helps us to avoid the innumerable pitfalls resulting from indecision. There are folks simply cannot make up their minds. They know what they would like, but they never quite have the courage to come to a clear decision on a matter of importance. This decision may involve business or family or friends, but still this decision is lacking. There is a hesitancy. Sometimes this hesitancy arises from an instinctive sense of inability. The person who does not know may hesitate to make a decision in an area where he recognizes that his knowledge is inadequate. Yet in the field of art again, for example, all men's knowledge is inadequate. There is no one who has ever been an expert in art or archaeological research who has been actually able to say that he could certainly be right. There is always indecision where facts are not available. And in most matters of importance and value, all facts are not available. So we must make decision upon some ground. We must decide about whether we will buy or sell that piece of property. We must decide on what we will invest, or whether it is good to change employment at this time. All these decisions must be made. And research with value helps us to make decision. And decision in its own turn is a clarifier. Even a wrong decision can be more valuable than a weak indecision. In a wrong decision, we face facts, or facts become obvious to us. When we attempt to evade decision, we evade facts. We learn nothing. We advance no cause, and we leave ourselves as weak as before. On the other hand, we cannot afford to make too many bad decisions, nor can we be deceived too often without perhaps exhausting our resources. Consequently, the importance of value again asserts itself. The great Lavater, the wonderful old early 19th century physiognomist, became a great expert in the analysis of human character. He took all of the instincts that an art dealer will turn to art and applied them to the strange artistry of the human face. In the face, he sought value. And he judged persons according to the values which he found. He learned that there is nothing that is a quicker way to be deceived than to accept people by what they say about themselves. Nor can we often depend upon their credentials. We have to judge credentials by someone else's opinion of a person. Actually, we have to know something ourselves. To know this, we must observe, compare, weigh, and intuit. These are the only courses by which we can escape a simple mediocrity of decision which may lead nowhere. So from the discovery of certain abstract value in art, we search value in something else. And we search for it by becoming aware of the true meaning of things. We have to build up some knowledge, but knowledge again can play us false if we do nothing with it. There are many persons whose knowledge in an area is extensive, but this knowledge has never passed from a theoretical to a practical level. The individual has never tested his knowledge. He has never believed sufficiently in it to really feel that he can depend upon it in an emergency. Now, when an art critic or an art lover examines a piece of Chinese porcelain, one of the first things he will do is very quietly turn it over and look at the bottom. Now, he does this because after he owns it or where it stands in the store, this is the part that is never shown. Now, from this part of the vase, he learns something. But he doesn't always learn what he is supposed to learn or what others think he is going to learn. Nearly all fine Chinese ceramics are signed. The signature is most likely to be on the bottom, the outside of the bottom of the piece. So naturally, turning it over, it is possible to see the signature or the seal or some other mark which identifies a potter or a kiln. Of course, unfortunately, there is nothing easier in the world to fabricate than a seal. Anywhere in the Orient, you can buy an excellent one for 50 cents and have it inscribed with anything you want on it. It would be just about equal, and I've seen things just about as strange, for a modern person to go in and have a seal made with the signature of Leonardo da Vinci on it. Now, if Leonardo had used a seal, it could be duplicated today without the slightest difficulty. Yet the seal is a very important thing in Asiatic life. A man's signature is meaningless, but his seal is terribly important, and the only substitute for it is his thumbprint. That will be acceptable. But an individual who very carefully endorses a document with his signature may well be told that his signature is not acceptable. They would much rather have his seal, because this is the real sign to these people of this person's actual existence. The seal is the person. But unfortunately, nothing is easier to fabricate. And while it is not likely that a living person's seal will be imitated, there are rigid laws about it, still there is no reason why ancient marks cannot be easily imitated. So while it might at least indicate what the piece is supposed to be, it does little more than confirm the appearance. But what the real critic is looking for is traditional methods, patterns, ways of doing things, which change with time and which the ordinary forger may well fail to imitate. For example, in most Ming ceramics, or those of later date, vases were made to stand in bases, and as a result of that, a kind of secondary rim was placed around the bottom so that it would fit neatly into the little teak wood stand. Earlier pieces never had this rim, so the man looking for an old piece may gain from that what he will never be able to learn from the possible fabrication of a seal. But it is to be observing. It is to see what should be seen, or as the dealer may say, to see that which the imitator hopes you will not see. That is just the point. And in all of this type of thing, the same drift has occurred that occurs in our modern way of life. Almost all reproductions are inferior. They are not inferior by the mere fact that they are reproductions. They are inferior by the fact that with the passing of time in both East and West, the quality of workmanship has gradually depressed. One reason, perhaps, was that the rising tide of economic need did not permit the artisan to spend as long at his labor. Or perhaps the original artist, like some of the European masters, lived under the favor of a prince who financed him and therefore gave him complete leisure. The copyist did not have this leisure. He is trying to create a livelihood, and he must do it by in some way cheapening his wares. So the great test of all things is the cheapening or the loss of quality of things. Now we observe this in life around us all the time now. Year after year, a cheapening is going on. the quality of merchandise, entirely apart from art, is falling rapidly. The so-called guarantees and promises have little or no significance. Consequently, the buyer is faced not only with the problem of bewareness, but he is faced with the need for ever-increasing observation in the effort to secure, if possible, the best available product. This means further support to his own resources. If he buys observingly and thoughtfully, his purchases will last longer and his funds will be conserved. Consequently, this continual awareness, this almost subconscious instinct for fineness, pays off even in the most ordinary walks of life. It pays off continuously in preventing us from being imposed upon by secondary merchandise. If we once gain a certain sense of value, we have gained with it the skill to discover a better level of value. We also come, of course, ultimately head on into the problem of the bargain, whether or not we can hope to get something below its reasonable value. In order to be a smart shopper, for example, a housewife will gradually develop an almost intuitive grasp of value. She may go to a sale where a great deal of merchandise is displayed. She has learned that when these sales are open to the public, a few good items may be concealed in a mass of trash. Much of the goods offered at the sale is not reduced at all. It is merely put in with the other smaller amount of valuable merchandise to increase bulk and to bring sales from the unobservant, from the unthoughtful, so that it is possible for her to go through a stock and find a few things of better value. Otherwise, merely bargain hunting, she may buy goods at more than its normal retail price. She has to know. There is no substitute for this knowledge. We value this skill where it applies directly to dollar saving, but we also should learn to value it where it applies to character protection, which is one of the areas in which value plays a very important part. We are imposed upon largely because we do not use the faculties and powers with which we have been naturally endowed. The average person today uses only about 20% of his brain potential. A large part of his mentality is never exercised because he is surrounded by so many protecting devices that his own thought processes are actually discouraged or prevented from functioning. Also, on an emergency, when he needs them, they are available only untrained and without any adequate background and experience in the problem which presents itself. So we have faculties, we have powers, which can protect us from deceit if we know how to use these powers. We also have powers within our own minds which will protect us from surrounding our consciousness with non-valuable materials. There can be no doubt whatever that the psychological influence of the things we have affects our character, affects our natures, affects our inward consciousness. If, therefore, we are without the realization and consciousness of discrimination, we do lower our environment. We may be spending more on it, but we are getting less for it. Now, a problem of value was presented to us with stark realism in the recent terrible fires in Bel Air and surrounding areas in western Los Angeles. Here we had people who built magnificent homes right up against a continuing fire hazard. They were warned not only by authorities, but by their insurance agents, that this situation existed. Many of these persons had homes full of valuable things, but they did not take adequate protection. They were not aware. They didn't hear the voice of experience and the warnings of those who attempted to protect them. They continued thoughtlessly and thereby took upon themselves a very heavy loss. To the thoughtful person, the first word of warning would have stirred sufficient internal activity to have caused adequate steps to be taken. But these persons simply didn't listen. They didn't care. They didn't believe. They didn't read the papers. They did not know that others in similar locations had suffered loss. There was a complete lack of thoughtfulness. And this lack of thoughtfulness was paid for in the terms of millions of dollars worth of material loss, to say nothing of tremendous loss of rare art, literature, and irreplaceable treasures of families and even of the nation. This type of thing simply shows poor value sense. Again, in our way of life, we have gradually come to be wrongly educated in value. We have failed to recognize the importance of protecting that which is good. We do not protect the good public servant. We do not properly reward the good workman. We do not make any effort whatever to discriminate between the levels of services that are rendered to us. As a result, the level slowly falls. Whereas thoughtfulness, discrimination, and integrity could have maintained these levels. Once they are gone, they are desperately difficult to restore. We have lost pride in the productions of our own efforts. The average family today has lost pride in its own ingenuity, in its own ability to use its resources well. Most families have lost pride in economy, regarding extravagance as the true symbol of the American way of life. These losses of essential values must be paid for in many ways, including much suffering and deprivation. And all that is really necessary to correct the situation is the gradual education of our own consciousness and the experience of knowing what is good. Now, it's true that we live in several worlds simultaneously. There is a larger world where our greater goods are involved. But there is also the smaller world of private experimentation and effort. Perhaps the smaller world of a particular interest becomes a laboratory in which we can experiment with principles that we can apply in many other areas as time goes on. So if we choose something as a symbol of the entire search for value, as for example art, we are only making a laboratory experiment. In art, we can control many factors. For example, an individual makes his own decision. He buys something. He thinks it's good. Later, he discusses with an expert and he finds out that it is not good. He learns why he was overcharged and he learns why his purchase was unwisely made. This whole situation may involve a few days of time and maybe $10, $20, or $50 in money. Here, the whole pattern works out. We can see the complete picture. But when we make a mistake in value of life and go out into the larger theater of our activity, this mistake may cost us dear. It may go on through for years, and we may never find the true expert who can tell us what is wrong. Consequently, by using the smaller theater of experimentation, we gain the experience and develop the faculties which we can then apply to larger and more diversified areas of activity. This is one of the principles behind art. This is one of the reasons why a collector gradually becomes more enlightened in value. It isn't that the things he is collecting are always important. Perhaps they are not important at all. But he is gaining an important sharpening of his own consciousness. He is learning to think more clearly. He is learning to understand more deeply. And most of all, he is learning to try to appreciate abstract value. In the presence of a great masterpiece of art, a true connoisseur may give a little exclamation of almost ecstasy. He sees something that is so wonderful that he can hardly restrain himself. We look at the same thing and we say, well, I guess it's all right. I don't see anything extraordinary about it. I think they had something like that down at Newbury's once. And we pass it at that. But what did the expert see that we missed? Why does he suddenly sense something as being of tremendous value? And to us, it's just something else that perhaps if we had it, we'd give it away gladly. In fact, you'd be surprised how many great treasures have actually been found in the trash cans out in front of people's houses. They've given away the wrong thing. They've thrown out something priceless and replaced it with something worthless. These things happen. Many very interesting and rare antiques have been found in dump yards. Why? Because the wrong people had them. People who did not know value. But what is the difference? How can we try to understand what this expert sees that we do not understand or do not comprehend? One thing he must see, or he wouldn't be interested at all, is beauty. He must see important beauty. He must see some form of extraordinary creative excellence, or he would not be moved nor interested. Why do we not see the same thing? Why are we not touched inwardly by the tremendous surge of appreciation that has risen in him? The only answer is that we're not trained, that we are not used to using those faculties in that way. We are used to measuring mediocrities. We have gone to school. We've learned a great many simple values about daily things. But we haven't learned abstract value. We haven't learned to grasp the beautiful and to find in it something essential to our own well-being. Probably if we asked this connoisseur why he was so tremendously attracted to a certain item, he might try to tell us. When he gets all through, we would probably agree with him and still not know what he was talking about, because we would look exactly where he pointed, but we wouldn't see what he saw. To us, we would see a very pleasant little area, perhaps of porcelain with a nice color on it. To him, he sees something perhaps unique. Maybe that particular example is the only piece of its kind in the United States. Perhaps he knows who created it and realizes that in some mysterious way a treasure has escaped the observant eyes of collectors and dealers and has suddenly appeared within his reach. He knows, therefore he appreciates. And appreciation must be built upon knowledge. And this is true in every department of life. Another point that we find in working with this, as we said, is the need for the immediate decision. And this comes upon even those who have considerable interest in these matters. The ancient rule on the subject is, for the expert, if you know that it is great and you can get it, get it. If you are not sure whether it is great or not, and you are an expert, leave it alone. Because if you do not take it, and you are not sure, and you are an expert, your subconscious is ringing a bell. There's something wrong, even though your consciousness may not be able to tell what it is. Whenever you are seriously in doubt, whenever you say to yourself, I don't feel quite right about this, the great collector leaves the item alone. He senses in some way that the offense arises from his own psychic level of appreciation. His consciousness is not really happy with this particular item. Now, what makes consciousness happy? Apparently, the real answer to this lies that consciousness is always happy when it recognizes something upon its own level. When it recognizes perfection, consciousness being of itself a perfect thing somewhere in its own source, even though it may not manifest perfectly. Consciousness recognizes consciousness in other things. Consciousness recognizes the skill of the great artisan. Consciousness shares in a superlative appreciation for that which is superlative. And from ourselves comes a sense of contentment, a sense of justification, a sureness that what we are considering arose also from a great consciousness. And this has to lie behind every achievement in creativity that is important. So if we are in doubt, and something says to hesitate, then it is not wise to proceed. Or certainly we should proceed with the greatest caution and thoroughness and protect ourselves in every way possible. Now, the same thing should happen when we meet people or when we come upon any problem in life. I've talked to a great many persons who have brought their problems, particularly problems involving other people. And in the course of a discussion, they may say, well, you know, it's a strange thing, but when I first met that person, I didn't get a good feeling from them. But gradually I decided it was my own temperament or my own snobbishness or something, and in the course of time I more or less forgot my original feeling. Now I suddenly realize that that original feeling was right. But it is only after considerable time that we get around to the proving of this intuitive flash that we had at the beginning. Therefore, we should always be mindful of these intuitive flashes. Now, there are certain persons who, by nature, are so critical, they will criticize everyone. This, of course, represents, again, a total loss of value, and therefore, their judgment is not important. But where we have naturally no antagonisms, no antipathies, no prejudices about a thing, yet at the very beginning of it, we sense something that isn't right. We sense the feeling that this is not good. Then we shouldn't let the hope for profit or the hope for improved fortune cause us to depart from that which we know instinctively to be right. Because if we mentalize this long enough, we will kill out this consciousness flash that we had. We will explain it away, but we will not change the circumstances. And maybe 5 years later or 10 years later, this intuitive flash will come through again. Now, there are cases psychologically in which this intuitive sensing has gone even further than this. I know one case in which a person thinking of going in a business which would have involved a considerable amount of commitment, had a little of this intuitive sense against the prospective business partner. But because the credentials were excellent, because the man's reputation apparently was above the question, the person felt that his superstitions were not proper, that he shouldn't feel that way. He had no reason to be suspicious of this other man. It was just some mood of his. But a few days before the time came for him finally to consummate this business transaction, he had a very important and impressive dream about it. The consciousness which was trying to warn him had not quite gotten through on the conscious level. Therefore, it came out in a powerful dream pattern, a dream of warning that was so real that this person could not resist it, and he did not complete the transaction. And it was very fortunate that he did not, because actually the entire situation was a misrepresentation and very close to outright dishonesty. But the psychic nature had sensed this. Now, how did the psychic nature sense it? Some will say, perhaps, that there was a certain clairvoyant faculty involved, that the person's inner life became aware, perhaps almost a sort of telepathic communication, in which the negative thought of the dishonest person was picked up by the potential victim and save the victim from the difficulty that threatened. This may be true. There are occasions where this is undoubtedly true. But I wonder if it is consistently the pattern. Because if it was, how could a very intuitive collector have the same feeling, equally strong, and perhaps a dream equally impressive, about a piece of tapestry that is 500 years old? We might say that the tapestry was haunted or something of that nature, but this gets the situation into a rather abstract atmosphere. It is far more likely that this person actually saw the fraud, but did not know how to interpret what he saw. That, however, his own subconscious picked up this forgery or this misrepresentation and was able to finally bring it through some symbolic medium. Perhaps in this case, simply a violent sense of don't buy it, I don't like it. Or perhaps again, some kind of a dream experience. There's one case of a dream of this kind in which a man was buying an expensive antique Egyptian jewel or piece of jewelry that was quite expensive. And he actually had a dream in which this figure appeared to him and told him that it was bogus, that it was a reproduction, and it later proved to be. In New York, there has been a plate that's being distributed among every art dealer practically in the Western Hemisphere. This plate is supposed to be a marvelous vessel from a Byzantine altar at St. Sophia's. A priceless thing. Dozens great collectors and great dealers have examined it. Not one of them ever found out that it was bad. But for some reason, none of them ever bought it. That was one of the peculiar things. Something always happened. The price was high. It was priced in the five figures and well into them. And it was passed on by the experts of every gallery and museum you could think of. But this piece has gone begging for years. Whereas other pieces with much less credential have found happy homes long ago. And then all of a sudden the bubble burst and the man who made it confessed. Instead of having been manufactured by some ancient craftsman 1,500 years ago, it was made in the Bronx about 1910. And not one of the persons who turned it down knew this. But for some reason the plate went begging. Although it had enough endorsement to have convinced the greatest skeptic. But nobody quite liked it, although it was a beautiful piece of work. So the expert learns in one way or another this overtone. If we could get this kind of instinct into our transactions with people on various levels, we'd have a lot more honesty in this world. We would discourage a great deal of fabrication and forgery, and various impoverishments of quality in various products that we commonly purchase. But we just do not get this sense of value operating correctly. Now, value carries on into other things. I know persons of very moderate means who, having come into the presence of something that they instinctively knew was good, have gone far beyond prudence and judgment in the effort to acquire that thing. To them, its value was so very real and so very important that they did not dare to hesitate. Under those conditions, most of these transactions came out very well because, of course, the essential element was this enlightened sincerity, which is very hard to deceive once you have attained it. So these persons have extended their resources in the direction of value almost imprudently, but actually very wisely, as time itself always proved. So to know and to grasp value is itself a tremendously important decision to make. And here we have again a decision in life. When we start out living, or when we're at any period in life, what should we do about value? When the opportunity arises for something that we know is good, or know is necessary, or know is right, are we willing fully to stand behind this and give everything we have to it? Have we sense enough to recognize opportunity, to recognize it for exactly what it is, and to be so skillful in our knowledge that we could not be deceived? If we have this opportunity, then do we have the courage to give full weight to our own intuition and do the thing that we know is correct? We have people all the time who come in and say, "Well, I knew years ago that what I'm doing wasn't right, but I just kept on doing it anyway, and I just wonder why I'm in a mess now." It's just this type of thing. There wasn't any clear sense of knowing what is right and doing it. To get, therefore, this credit out of value, to make value work for you, it must create this censorship and discrimination and intensify our own abilities to decide to cling to value, to do that which is indicated as the best and wisest thing to do. Now, this value does not mean in terms of money. I'm not thinking in terms of investment primarily. I'm thinking in terms of character, in terms of those decisions which make for happiness or unhappiness within ourselves as living creatures. For here is where value operates most positively at all times. So we say, the Chinese say at least, that we must reach out and take hold upon value. That we should always choose that which is best in the presence of a number of possible decisions. And to do this, we must have thoughtfulness. And to this, we must have training, and we must have experience. And we must have all of these elements of maturity which make it possible for us to recognize value, give ourselves the courage to accept the challenge of value, and then the patience to perfect whatever elements are necessary in the transaction. These conditions are not commonly found today. The person of today is not thoughtful. He is not skillful in the determination of value. He is not particularly interested in training himself for any of these activities. I know in philosophy particularly how indifferent people are to the more subtle phases of emotional reaction to that which is fine or good. Religion and philosophy, instead of deepening the sense of values, make us hasten over them without giving them adequate consideration. Perhaps that's why so much of our religious life is not adequate and not mature and not helpful to us in our own emergency. So let's try to take a few little simple illustrations paralleling different fields of activity and see what we mean now by taking hold of value and trying to do something with it. Do something to make things better for all concerned. We are, we'll say, moderately educated people. We've had enough schooling to be able to make a living. We have enough skill in some art or trade to be able to have a measure of proficiency in it. We are managing some way to get along from day to day. We don't exactly know how ourselves, and nobody else seems to be able to give us much instruction on it. But here we are, more or less drifting. Tomorrow is another day, which will gradually look more and more like this one as we begin to live it. There is no particular reason to assume that we're going to wake up tomorrow any smarter than we were when we went to bed. And there's not much of incentive in it. One thing that value requires is incentive. Now, where do we find this incentive by which an individual is suddenly shaken out of a rut and becomes dynamically concerned with something? This problem of drifting along from day to day, bored largely, or wasting time, or worrying about ourselves, there doesn't seem to be much dynamic in us. If you can transfer this situation to somebody who, as one man I know years ago, collected glass doorknobs. Now, there is what you might term the ultimate end of some kind of culture. I don't know just what kind it is. The only other parallel to it that I know of is blown glass paperweights. Now, this person, however, really considered doorknobs to be something apart from almost every other value in life. God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh, and on the eighth day he made doorknobs. I don't know what the situation was, but these doorknobs were little less than an obsession. He was a lonely man. He didn't have too many general interests in life. He didn't have a kind of income that would enable him to collect Van Dykes. Therefore, he had something, however, that just made life wonderful for him. Every day he rose in the morning filled with hope that before dark he would find another doorknob. And he usually did. Sometimes he had great days when he found two doorknobs. He had a house full of them. Perhaps his psychologist would regard this as a symbol of compound infantilism. I don't know. But this man had a lot of fun with doorknobs. And so many people who are much too intelligent to collect doorknobs don't have any fun at all about anything. This man had something. Not only this, but it led him into a great deal of research. He began to find out all kinds of interesting things about who made doorknobs. Maybe no one else in the community was interested. But in the end, he hoped he was going to write the only authoritative textbook on doorknobs. And I'll wager you that if he does it, he will probably win a prize. Because it all fits into a funny little pattern. This man had achieved something. He became an authority on doorknobs. Most people never become an authority on anything. Now, when he departs from this life, as he most certainly will, he's going to leave all his doorknobs behind. But he's going to take with him a very interesting, adventurous consciousness, because he did something. And other people are going to leave the practical things that they did instead behind. And the man that laughs at the man who collected doorknobs is going to leave his gilt-edged securities behind when he goes also. And when this little mortal span is finished, the value of doorknobs and gilt-edged securities are not going to be very different to that person. It's all part of life. But out of an interest came a constantly increasing awareness of some kind of value. This is important to people because it is one of the few remedies we have for the compound doldrums in which most people find themselves. Now, I can think of better things than doorknobs. I can also think of better things than another man I knew who had about 20,000 different old campaign buttons of Republican and Democratic candidates, most of whom are forgotten. In this collection alone, the names of who might have been a senator or who might have been a congressman are only preserved in just such things as these. No one really cares, but it was exciting to find another campaign button. This person at least was doing something to fight against his own boredom. And regardless of whether what he collected was any good or not, this individual was gradually developing resources of faculty and consciousness. Someday he might collect better things. Someday this power might go into an entirely different channel, infinitely more profitable to mankind. But there was action. The mind was being used in some way. The faculties of observation were being developed. Some hobbies develop only one faculty, memory. But the average person even needs that. One faculty will develop observation of color. this can be useful. Perhaps someday this person may become an artist. But whatever we do is better than not to do anything. And we must constantly strive to develop observation and reflection, classification. Now, when you start studying psychological faculty problems, for instance, there is nothing, perhaps, that would seem to be very creative in the collecting of some small, trivial things. For instance, a collection of the coins of Syracuse, these beautiful gold, silver, and bronze coins of ancient Greece. There doesn't seem to be much creativity about collecting such things. If you have the money, the interest, you can collect them. But I've never seen two collectors of these types of things who presented their collections in the same way. The artistry of the collector may be expressed in the magnificent way in which he brought these things together in a wonderful, dramatic pattern. He didn't create the coins. He didn't design them. But he at least knew how to present them in display so that other persons got the maximum impact from them. Another man with just as much money collecting somewhat similar objects kept them all in a canvas bag. There was no way. There's the artistry of the individual does come out. And we have to create it. We have to escape from this absolute lack of interest in anything beyond the daily problem, the daily grind of things. We have to have these positive release mechanisms. If we do not, we are candidates for serious psychological problems, especially now, where the tensions and the tempers of many people are on severe edge. There has to be this creativity. So out of all of this problem, we come up with a luxury factor that doesn't seem to mean anything. And yet around this luxury factor may come the greatest actual growth that we make. A person who lives 70 years, 75, 80 years, and dies without having touched creativity, has simply lived a very provident, prudent, orderly, matter-of-fact, utterly dull existence. This person has very little to take with them. Whatever they have in the form of inner consciousness is all they can take. What does this person have to take? Almost nothing. They've never even experienced real joy in anything. They've never had any fun at anything they've done. It's all been problem, work, seriousness, and massive decisions involving anything from $10 to $10 million. But very dull, non-creative, non-self-expressive, and certainly not inclined to create any consciousness which calls upon faculties for verification. I forgot to mention, incidentally, that doorknobs have been counterfeited. There are rare doorknobs. You can pay thousands of dollars for a doorknob. And the problem, therefore, also is discrimination as to whether it's worth it or not. But whatever the problem is, faculties are brought into play. Something is stirred up in the individual. He likes something very much. And that is more than most people ever really do. It's amazing how little color comes into the majority of human lives, particularly the color that arises from rejoicing, from victory over circumstance, from the discovery of something long sought. We don't have that type of experience. And as a result, our temperaments are impoverished. So we like to think that this problem of value has something to do with the enthusiasm of life. That this enthusiasm of life is contagious. We also know that people who have these interests are easier people to live with. That they are not by any means as difficult to work with. Persons with interests and dramatic and dynamic outlets are nice to be around, usually. Whereas persons with none of these outlets get very heavy, tiresome, tiring kinds of attitudes, which are hard to live with. So value should make us always try to enrich life with something that is not just necessary. I know people who say that these frills upon the circumference of existence are meaningless. After all, life is a very serious business, and there's no time really to fritter away in foolish avocational activities. I've known these people, but they weren't very friendly people. They were not the kind of people that made good grandparents or good friends. They were people who lived very much in the square-toed Puritanism, in which it seems as though even a smile is little less than sacrilegious. They were not the kind of people who have warm, happy, healthy lives. So it's sometimes very good, in a sense of value, to simply remember this thought that Muhammad gave us, namely that had he two coats, he would sell one and buy pink hyacinths for his soul. You have to do something with these things for the soul. And the soul wants to be fed graciousness, beauty, charm, perhaps almost childish enthusiasm over something. The moment life loses its enthusiasm, we might just as well lie down and call it a day. It is enthusiasm that makes life. And enthusiasm comes from two words, entheos, which means in God. Therefore, the enthusiast is living in God. He is living in some kind of a spiritual state of active awareness. And it's hard to get enthusiasm unless the mind can move out of what we term the necessary into some larger vista, which we might almost consider to be an extravagant place to live. But what is extravagance? I think extravagance can occur to a very practical person. I know people who would consider themselves very, very thrifty, who are utterly extravagant. And I know people who would be considered highly extravagant, who are most prudent. It depends entirely on the judgment of another person whose interests may be different.